Hey everybody, good morning, welcome to class, and this is Bio 231, and it's May 6th. We're going to take a look at the schedule in just a second. We're going to finish up respiratory system today and move on to digestive system. That's the plan, and I think we're looking really good. So I'll just turn a couple of these lights down, like that one right there. We're ready to go. So, today is May 6th. Indeed, we're going to get into digestive system, which means we only have urinary system and diversification system after that to cover. All right, so today's the 6th, a week from today's the 13th. So that's 1 week, 2 weeks from today. May 20th is exam number 4. And it's chapters 19 through 25. And what are we on? We're on 23. We're going to get done with 24 today, and that just leaves 25 for next week. The other thing about the very last week, either the 18th on Monday or the 20th, once again on Wednesday, that's when you have your last practicum. Okay, so you got a lab this week. Most people are done with a lab this week, except for one lab, and then next week there's a lab, and then that's it. During this practicum, during that practicum time, you might have a quiz and the practicum, but no lab after that, right? So it's just going to be mostly the practicum, and the quiz is pretty short and sweet, because I want everybody to have 10 quizzes on their grade sheet, because usually you all do really good on quizzes. I know you have to work, you have to apply yourself, but a lot of people get 100% on those quizzes, and that helps you with the lecture exam as well. So I want 10, so you don't get cheated out of some good points for those quizzes. All right, anybody have a question on the schedule at all? Pretty straightforward. And we go over the lab schedule in particular, but I think the labs are lab number 9, 11, 12, and 13 on that last practicum. Right? 10 you've been tested on already. Okay, part of the quiz for next week is going to be draw and label the bile duct system. And we're in the respiratory chapter right now, but I want to draw it out on the board so I don't forget to show you. There is a video in Blackboard. It's an excellent video, but I want to just draw it right now so that you guys can draw it out. Then you can watch the video, draw it out again, and then it will be really easy. All right, so draw and label the bile duct system. Draw and label bile duct system. All right, so bile is a compound. It's a substance, and it's secreted into a duct by the liver. All right, so liver makes bile, and it secretes it into a duct. So is that an endocrine function or an exocrine function of the liver? When it makes that product, bile, and it secretes it into a duct. Is that part of the endocrine system or exocrine system? Okay. Remember, endocrine is an organ that makes a chemical compound that it secretes, and then it gets picked up by the blood vessel someplace and then transported all over the body. That's an endocrine system. Exocrine is when an organ makes a product, secretes it into a duct. That's an exocrine. So this is an exocrine function of the liver. And okay, suppose you have some butter, right, and you get some on your clothes. Can you just get a wet paper towel and get that greasy butter off your clothes? No, because oil and water don't mix, right? Well, we have a lot of oil in our diet, but it doesn't like to dissolve in our body because our body is mostly water. So bile is the substance that allows oil and fats to dissolve in water. We call that emulsification. So bile is sort of like a detergent in a sense, right? Because you can use a detergent to get oily stuff off your clothes, and that's what bile does. It allows us to package lipids and digest lipids. But we don't need to have bile going to our small intestine all the time because we're not eating all the time. But the liver is making bile all the time, so there's a place where it's stored for a little bit. All right, so here is what I want you to do for that diagram. First, I want you to draw the liver out. Here's a pretty good, oh, that's excellent. Excellent drawing of a liver. Alright, so we're just going to say liver right here. Most of the liver is on what side of your body, right or left?
Right.
It's on the right side. So let's go ahead and label that. So here is the right side, here is the left. Pretty much just like the heart. Okay, so liver is way over here on your right side. It's making bile all the time and secretes it right into a duct. Here are two. One coming from the right, one coming from the left. So this one over here is the right hepatic duct. Bless you. And anytime you hear that term hepatic or hepo or something like that, it means liver, right? So a hepatic duct is a duct in the liver. This one's on the right side. So what does make this one right here? That's the left hepatic duct. Okay, so far is that easy points? Yeah, that's pretty easy. All right, well, it looks like these two things are going to join together the way I drew it, and indeed they do. The right and left hepatic duct forms one duct, and that's called the common hepatic duct. Okay, now here's a little bit of a branch point. I'm just going to draw a duct going down like that and stop for a second. I'm going to come back to that. But I'm going to draw a branch coming off over here. And under the liver, there is a little sac, right, that contains bile. And this thing right here is called the gallbladder. So in terms of your digestive system, you can be in one of two states. One is in a fasted state, when you haven't eaten anything for a number of hours, like when you wake up in the morning, you're in a fasted state. And then after you have some bacon, this is a little foreshadowing of lab for you guys that had lab this afternoon. Okay, then you're in a fed state, right? So you're either in a fasted or fed state. I don't know what state you're in right at the moment. But when you're in a fasted state, that bile that is produced by the liver doesn't have to go to the digestive system because there's nothing there. So in that case, it goes to the gallbladder and it's stored in the gallbladder until you eat something. And then it leaves the gallbladder and it goes to your digestive tract. This duct leading in and out of the gallbladder, there's only one tube going in and out, that's called the cystic duct. And how should I draw that? Ooh, cystic duct. I'll put a kind of a lead line over here like this, and I'll put an arrow, right? Cystic duct. All right, so in lab, the easiest thing to find first is the gallbladder. There's going to be one tube coming out of it. That's easy. That's the cystic duct. Okay. And then you can find the right and left hepatic ducts. Now, this thing right here is going to go into the pancreas. So here's the pancreas. Kind of looks like that. And the pancreas has a duct running through it as well. So the pancreas is part exocrine gland because it makes digestive enzymes. And the tube joins to the pancreatic duct. All right, so I'm going to label what pancreas. And pancreatic duct. Like so. They join together, and where they join together, they empty into the small intestine. There's some small intestine, right? So here's small intestine. So the only thing that I didn't label is this tube from the cystic duct down into the pancreas. And that's really easy. That's called the bile duct. Sometimes you could call it the common bile duct, but you don't even have to say common. You can just say bile duct. Bile duct is this one right here. Okay. All right, so it looks really straightforward to me, but let's go over it just one more time. Because maybe if you haven't seen this organization in your mind before, it still might not look really clear. might just look like a jigsaw puzzle all spilled out on the table. Okay, the organ that makes bile is the liver. Here's a liver, and liver pretty much looks like that, mostly on the right side of your body, producing bile all the time. And here's a duct that the liver secretes bile into. It's on the right side of the liver. Here is a similar kind of duct, but it's on the left side of the liver, right? So we have right and left. Another name for liver is hepato, right? So these are hepatic ducts, right and left hepatic ducts. They anastomose, which means what? Joined together. And it forms the common hepatic duct. Whenever you hear that word common, you should think, well, there's something that joins together to make something that's common or splits apart. Here's a common hepatic duct. And bile can be stored in the gallbladder. And it gets into the gallbladder. Tell me, what's the name of this duct? I'm hiding it. That is the cystic duct. That's right. So gallbladder, easy landmark to find. Cystic duct is easy to find. But when you're in a fed state, bile doesn't go into the gallbladder, it goes into the small intestine. And in order to get into the small intestine, it enters the pancreas and joins with the pancreatic duct. And then that empties into the small intestine. All right, so on the diagram, how many organs do you have to know? Liver, gallbladder, pancreas, small intestine. How many organs is that? Four organs. Right, so you can count them up, make sure you have them all on the diagram. Now what about ducts? Right hepatic duct, left hepatic duct, common hepatic duct, cystic duct, bile duct, pancreatic duct. There's six. Six ducts. All right, and that's why I think it's really handy to draw it out so that you don't get confused. Right, because there's six of these ducts and it's easy to get confused. So this will be part of the quiz for next time. Draw and label the bile duct system. And you can label it bile duct system if you want. And then you got to have those four organs and those six ducts. And you got to draw them so that the relationship is fine. All right, so I don't care if you draw a liver like that. It could just be a square, right? But you should know what's the right and left side. I don't care if you draw the pancreas really cool like that. It could just be a nice big rectangle. I just want to know the relationship of these things to each other. That's the most important thing. Okay? All right, so that's going to be in the digestive system, which is what we're going to cover next time. Who's got a question about that? Anybody got a question with that? Good. All right, that will help on the lecture exam and the practicum as well. All right, so we were in the respiratory system. Anybody have any questions on the respiratory system before we move on? That's good. Okay. So let me just ask you a question. What's the structural and functional unit of gas exchange in the lungs? Okay, it happens in a capillary, but there's a part of the lung that... Yeah, the alveolus. The alveolus is just that special shape that allows for a lot of exchange of oxygen going into the blood, carbon dioxide leaving your body. And remember, around the alveolus, there's a lot of elastic tissue, so that when an alveolus expands, when the diaphragm relaxes, an alveolus goes back to its normal shape, then that helps you exhale. Okay. So I think we're down by control of respiration. Control of respiration, we talked about the respiratory membrane. Well, where respiration is controlled is in the medulla and pons. Anybody remember where that is, medulla and pons? Brainstem, yeah, it's right smack above the spinal cord. And there are some centers that control the rate and depth of respiration. And one of those centers, okay, this right here, the VRG, sometimes we call this the rhythmicity center. You could think of it as a rhythmicity center, but even better, you should think of it as a pacemaker. And where else do you have a pacemaker? In your heart. What's the name of the pacemaker? I'd like the scientific name. Yeah, the sinoatrial node, SA node is really good. And that SA node has its own rhythmicity, right? It causes contraction Right. And so the same thing for this rhythmicity center in the respiratory control center in the medulla. But there are a couple other things, just like the heart can be regulated, like sympathetic nervous system can increase the activity of the SA node, parasympathetic, and decrease. So what's the relationship between parasympathetic and sympathetic? Yeah, they're antagonistic to each other, right? And these other groups will affect the rhythmicity center, and they are antagonistic to each other as well. So one will promote inspiration, the other will promote expiration by inhibiting the process of inspiration. And if some of the nuclei that inhibit the inspiratory group get damaged, maybe somebody has a stroke, then somebody is always going to be inhaling. They'll be gasping, they'll be inhaling. Right, but what is that going to be like if you're inhaling all the time? I can't even talk if I'm inhaling all the time, right? So if you can't exhale, then you can't get fresh air into your lungs. So that's a terrible condition to be in, right, if the inhibitory center is damaged. Furthermore, if more of the centers are damaged, right, this is not a part of the autonomic nervous system, but it does work automatically, right? So when you fall asleep, you stop breathing? Typically no, otherwise you wouldn't be here today, right? So this system works even while you're sleeping unless you have damage to this area, maybe due to a stroke. And in that case, the only time that you will take a breath is when you consciously make that happen, like contracting a biceps muscle, right? Because the diaphragm is skeletal muscle. So people with that kind of damage to this respiratory control center have to think about breathing every time they take a breath. Now, what happens to them when they fall asleep? They stop breathing because they're no longer thinking about breathing, right? And so, of course, they would pass away if that were to happen, right? Or they would be waking up all the time, short of breath and gasping for air. So when they fall asleep with a respirator, and that respirator inflates their lungs for them so that they can get a good night's sleep. So that's a kind of a strange disease to have, or pathology to have. And does anybody know the name of that particular pathology where every time you breathe in, you consciously have to make that happen? You have to think about it. It's called Odin's curse. Odin's curse when that happens. Okay, so that respiratory center is really important for automatic breathing. All right, and so that respiratory center then sends electrical information, nerve impulses down to the most important muscle for breathing in, for inspiration, and that is the diaphragm. And how do those nerve impulses get to the diaphragm? You really should know the name of this nerve and where the nerve comes from. It is called the phrenic nerve, and I don't know if that's on the third practicum or fourth practicum. Maybe it's the fourth practicum still coming up. You should be able to identify where that phrenic nerve is on the nerve man that we have in lab. And that goes to the diaphragm. If the phrenic nerve gets damaged, then the diaphragm can't contract and you can't breathe, and that means you're just not going to stay alive for very long if that happens. So where does the phrenic nerve come from? The diaphragm is way down here, right between the thoracic. It's right below the thoracic cavity, separating it from the abdominal cavity. But the phrenic nerve comes from the cervical region and goes all the way down to the diaphragm. But remember, there is a nerve plexus in the cervical region, which allows for nerve impulses to take alternate routes to get to an important organ, like the diaphragm. So if the information doesn't come out of one level of your neck, it comes out of three levels, and I think I told you a little way that you can help remember what are the levels that contribute to the phrenic nerve, and that is C3, C4, and C5. That's the origin of the phrenic nerve. So on the practicum, that's sort of where you would start to look for the phrenic nerve, up in that region, not down by the diaphragm. All right, what's that little saying that you can say to help you remember the origin of the phrenic nerve? I like C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. you could say C3, C4, C5 keeps you alive, but it doesn't have quite the same swing as C3, 4, 5 keeps you alive. Okay. Okay. All right, so that's the output to the diaphragm that comes from your central nervous system. And what controls your normal breathing are things, certain chemicals like oxygen concentration in your body, one of the waste products of respiration in your body, that is CO2. All right, so we produce CO2 and then we breathe it out of our body because it's pretty toxic, and also pH. So these are chemicals, and in order for your body to be able to understand the level of these chemicals, what does your body have to have? Okay, so in order for you to perceive light, what do you need to have? A receptor, a photoreceptor, right? So if your body can't perceive concentration of these chemicals inside your body, what do you have? You have chemoreceptors, chemical receptors. And you have chemical receptors for these compounds in two regions of your body, mostly two regions, and then there's a subclassification in another one, right? There are central receptors. Central receptors you find in the, where's your central nervous system? That's what it means. Brain and spinal cord, okay? But the chemoreceptors are in your brain, in particular the medulla oblongata is where you have chemoreceptors. Right, for CO2, oxygen, and pH. And what is pH? I don't know if we've ever gone over pH. What does pH mean? It's a measure of something. It's a measure of acidity in your body. That's right. It's kind of a strange little number because the number changes from 1 to 14. That's not really hard to know, just 14. But as the acidity increases, there's a strange thing, the pH number decreases. Right, so a pH of 7 is a lot more basic than a pH of 1. Or you could say a pH of 1 is a lot more acidic than a pH of 7. Right, so as the acidity increases, the pH number actually goes down. And in chemistry and physiology, you'll work with an equation that shows you how to calculate it really nice and easily. Okay, so you got chemoreceptors in the medulla oblongata. We call those central receptors because they're in the central nervous system. We also have peripheral receptors. What does that mean? That means outside the central nervous system. And in particular, they're in the aortic arch. You know where that is. And also the carotid sinus. I don't think your book does a really good job of showing you where the carotid sinus is, but I mentioned it in lecture a couple times. Okay, where would you kind of find the carotid sinus? Where is that at? Yeah, it's in your cervical region, right? That's where the common carotid, we used that word common before, common carotid bifurcates into the internal and external carotid arteries, right? And that's right in your neck. So there are chemoreceptors there. All right, so we said oxygen, CO2, and acidity control respiration. Which one do you think would be maybe the most important? Which one is your body really going to look at, pay attention to help adjust respiration, your ventilation rate? Okay. Well, I know how important oxygen is, right? We can, if our brain runs out of oxygen, we can maintain consciousness only for a couple seconds, 2 to 3 seconds. After 2 to 3 minutes, our brain actually dies if it doesn't have oxygen. So for the longest time, I thought oxygen would be the most important compound your body looks at. But that is not the case. The most important compound is carbon dioxide. Small changes in carbon dioxide can make big changes in the way that you ventilate, how much you breathe in and out. All right, so that's what I have here. Under chemoreceptors, central receptors, I have an up arrow with CO2, so if CO2 levels increase, or if the pH level decreases, that increases ventilation. Oxygen, actually, not so much, which is, I think, surprising. All right, so I see a down arrow by pH, right? So increasing CO2, decreasing pH. But what does that decreasing pH really mean? It is more acidic. Yeah, as your body becomes more acidic, that will help stimulate your ventilation rate. In the peripheral receptors in the carotid sinus and aortic arch, These can be sensitive to oxygen, but only when there is a drastic, drastic change in oxygen concentration will these stimulate ventilation, right? So this is like the last resort. So most of the drive for ventilation comes from CO2, right? And then this way depressed oxygen concentration in your body will cause you to gasp, to try to get some air inside your body when oxygen concentration goes way, way up. That has some funny side effects and some serious side effects. I know some people like to go fishing out in the ocean, not with a fishing reel, but with a spear gun, and without any air tank, they just dive down into the ocean, swim around under the water, and fish for fish, right? They can be 30 feet down, so they have to hold their breath for a long period of time, okay? The drive for you wanting to breathe is CO2, so there's kind of a little technique you can use to hold your breath a longer period of time. And that is, if you hyperventilate, if you move air in and out of your lungs really fast, your body loses a lot of CO2 so that you can hold your breath for a longer period of time. So CO2 starts to build up, right? And it just takes longer to build up to that concentration to where you want to take a breath. So people can do that, right? They can hold their breath for a long period of time. But when you hold your breath, what happens to oxygen concentration in your body? It starts to go down. And what do you need oxygen for? To make ATP, right? So when somebody hyperventilates on the surface of the ocean to get rid of a lot of CO2 so they can hold their breath longer, and then they go underwater, what are they using up? They're using up oxygen, but since CO2 is not a really high concentration in their body, they don't have an urgency to breathe because they're not aware, because they've gotten rid of all of this CO2. But in the meantime, what's happening? Oxygen is going down, and these people can just pass out underwater because that drive for breathing went away, which is CO2, right? If they don't have CO2 in your body, you don't have that urgency to breathe. But when you run out of oxygen, what happens to your brain? It shuts down, they pass out, and then what's the issue with that, with these divers, if you pass out? Yeah, you drown, because as soon as you pass out, then your respiratory center is going to take over and you start to breathe and you're underwater. That's really a bad thing. Okay. That's with those free divers. There's another clinical condition. Sometimes somebody will have a brain injury, and basically their brain will be dead, but their heart is still beating, and they're hooked up to a respirator, so their lungs are inflating. They're getting oxygen inside your body, and then somebody has to make a decision what to do for these people that are really dead because their brain is dead. You have to take them off of a ventilator and take them off of other kind of support systems, right? So hopefully you don't have to ever go through that with a family member. But so it's a difficult decision. And as that dead person loses oxygen because you turn the respirator off, the oxygen concentration gets less and less and less in their body. And then finally, what happens to the respiratory center when the oxygen concentration to their brain decreases after you turn off the machine that is breathing for them? It stimulates ventilation, and they take a big gasp or maybe a couple gasps of air. And that's really sad and really, really scary, because this person is really dead. And if it's a loved one and all of a sudden they start gasping for air, right, that's really horrible. Something to go through. Hopefully you're alerted to that. That's called an agonal reflex, right? But it's not because they're alive. It's just because this respiratory center was still functioning, okay? Not really their brain, okay? Right. Well, since the respiratory center is part of the brain, it's connected to other parts of the brain, like the cerebral cortex and hypothalamus. The cerebral cortex allows you to voluntarily control respiration. Like right now, we all could hold our breath, right? We could hold our breath and inhibit respiration, as a matter of fact, until we all pass out. I've never had a class do that. Maybe we should do that one of these days. I'll just hold our breath till we pass out. Right, we can, because the cerebral cortex controls the respiratory center. And then also there's something that happens more automatically. Our respiratory rate changes with emotional stimulus via the hypothalamus, right? So that's in the brain that it can affect respiratory rate. So if you ever get some really exciting news or sad news, right, you can gasp as well, or your ventilation rate can change as a result of that. Some other things that can affect ventilation, proprioceptors. And these are special sensors that monitor muscle tension, or actually tension within a tendon, and the state of contraction, the length of a muscle, proprioceptors. We talked about these. You have them in all your skeletal muscles and your joints. And right now, are you exercising? Are you exercising right now? Are you sweating, hyperventilating, anything? No, you're in a pretty nice relaxed state. All right, so, and you're sitting down. If you were to move your arms around without a weight even, and move your legs around, your knees and your hips, without a weight or pushing on anything, your respiratory rate would increase because your body is thinking that it is exercising, even though your metabolism isn't having to work any harder. All right, so just by using muscles and making joints angulate, that will stimulate an increase in respiration. And then lastly, a couple other things. Touch pain and temperature can affect respiration. For instance, if I take a pin and poke you in the arm, what will happen to your respiratory rate? It will immediately go up, right? So pain can stimulate via the central nervous system, ventilation, touch is the same way, and temperature, right? Especially a cold temperature. We should actually do this in lab. If I had an ice cube and put it on your back and you didn't know it was coming, what would you do? You probably have an idea. You'd do this before you punched me. You would go like that, okay? That's a gasp reflex, right? So if all of a sudden something cold hits your body, you're going to go through that gasp reflex. And I have sort of an interesting little story. It happened in Marina del Rey, which is a town pretty close to Los Angeles International Airport. There's a harbor there. And some of these harbors have boats that you can rent. Like if you have a wedding, you can get a bunch of people on the boat and they just kind of go around the harbor and they can have a ceremony and you can celebrate. Like New Year's Eve is a nice time. Christmas, people will rent these kind of things out. They're called hornblower yachts. I'm sure Newport has them and various other harbors up and down the coast. Well, one Christmas Eve, there were a bunch of people on one of these boats out in Marina del Rey just going up and down the harbor, and it was pitch black out, right, because in the wintertime it gets dark really early. And they were all dressed up in tuxedos and fancy dresses. The women had dresses on, right, and the guys had tuxedos. And all of a sudden the boat stopped. They're in the middle of the harbor, and it caught on fire, okay? And the engine wouldn't work, so the boat couldn't move. They didn't have any lifeboats on this particular vessel because it never went onto the ocean, just stayed in the harbor. So guess what the people had to do in their fancy dresses and tuxedos? They had to jump into the water, right, in just total darkness. And I read that and I go, oh, this sounds really bad. Does that sound really bad? That sounded really bad. I mean, it'd be really uncomfortable because how is the ocean? Is the ocean kind of nice and warm, or it's cold as hell, right? And you got to jump in with all these clothes on. Well, the newspaper report I read said that nobody drowned. Everybody got to shore or appeared just fine. And I was just really amazed because what happened to all those people when they jumped into the ocean? And all this cold water hit them because they weren't wearing wetsuits or any kind of equipment. They jumped in. What did they do? Gasp reflex, right? As soon as you hit that cold water, you go like that. And when you jump in and go kaplunk, where's there a chance your head might be when you go like that? It could be underwater, right? And so nobody drowned. I was just amazed. I couldn't figure out what was going on, but I think I figured out what happened is that they didn't have lifeboats, but they probably had life preservers, and everybody put on a life jacket before they jumped in, and that probably kept their head above the surface of the water enough so they didn't drown. Okay, so I don't know, just think of those poor people all dressed up and then jumping into the ocean in the middle of the night. That'd be really rude thing to have to go through. Okay. All right, so that's something about that gasp reflex, right? Your ventilation rate can be adjusted by a number of things, pain and temperature, your conscious control, emotional status and all those different kind of things. Or it can be controlled automatically by the respiratory control center. Where do we have that respiratory control center? It is in the brainstem, namely the pons and the medulla. Okay. All right, anybody have any questions over respiratory center? Or the respiratory system in general? Okay, we're pretty good. So I'll put those things away. All right, now we can get into the digestive system. Okay, sometimes this is a really fun lecture for me to give, right, because the digestive system is really disgusting when you start to study it a lot, right, and it's just fun to talk about something that's really messy all the time. All right, so what are the components of the digestive system? All right, so I'll put a slide on. Well, we have the oral cavity, that's your mouth, right, and then we have a connecting tube between your mouth and the stomach, that's called the esophagus. And then we have a number of organs here that are responsible for doing some digestion and absorption of nutrients, like the stomach. The stomach's connected to the small intestine. Small intestine's connected to the large intestine. And then here's the other end, right? The anus. That's how digested food material leaves the body. Enters the mouth, leaves via the anus. So besides these organs that are responsible for digestion and absorption, there are some other organs that help the alimentary canal, right? We just described the alimentary canal. It's just a tube inside your body. These other organs help the alimentary canal do their job. So we could consider these like accessory organs, accessory structures. And some of these accessory structures will be salivary glands. Right, and remember, you have two parotid glands. Oh, some people didn't have lab yet, but later this afternoon, if you have lab this afternoon, you'll see a parotid gland. You'll see a gland underneath the tongue. Lingual means tongue. If it's underneath the tongue, it's the sublingual gland. And then there's one kind of tucked away underneath the mandible. That's the submandibular gland. That secretes saliva. Saliva is mostly a lubricant so that food can slide down the esophagus and enter the stomach. It also has an enzyme for some initial digestion of complex sugars, like starch. It can start to break starch down, but it's not a very important enzyme in people because how long do you chew your food for before you swallow? Like 5 minutes, 10 minutes? Not even a minute, right? A couple seconds, 5, 10 seconds. And that's the only period of time that enzyme has to work because as soon as it hits the stomach, then it's inactivated by the acids that are in the stomach. That's more important in other kinds of animals, but we still have that enzyme activity. All right, so what else? What are some other accessory organs? Well, we have the liver. The liver produces a compound that's very much like a detergent. It's bile, and that bile allows us to absorb and process fats because remember, fats don't and oil don't dissolve in water. They just don't mix. Our body is mostly made out of water, so that when we eat a fatty material, it wouldn't even go into our body. It couldn't be digested unless it's broken down. That process we call emulsification, and that product that emulsifies lipids is bile. Okay, and it's a job of the liver to produce it. And the gallbladder stores bile that the liver produces until you're in a fed state, until you have food actually going through the digestive system. Bile doesn't need to go through the digestive system or into the digestive system when you're in a fasted state, when you're not eating anything. Right? And then there's some ducts that move this bile around. Here is a pancreas tucked away underneath the stomach. That's an important organ because it produces digestive enzymes and some compounds that can neutralize acid coming from the stomach before it reaches the small intestine. And that's another organ that has an exocrine function because it secretes those digestive enzymes into this structure right here. What do we call this thing? Kind of looks like a fish right there. That is the pancreatic duct, right? So that's an exocrine function that ends up into the small intestine. Fortunately, those digestive enzymes that are made by the pancreas are made in an inactive form. Because if they were secreted into the pancreatic duct in an active form, what would happen to the pancreatic duct? It would get digested, right? And then the pancreas would get digested. That's not a good thing at all, Right? So they're made in an inactive form. When they get into the small intestine, they become activated. That's really, really nice. That doesn't always work. And if it doesn't work that way, that's a very serious condition when the pancreas starts to digest itself, right? Like pancreatitis is real serious. People can die from that really easily. Pancreatic cancer is one of the worst kind of cancers, right? And that's partly one of the reasons why. All right, so what did I miss? Oral cavity, teeth and tongue, right? Well, tongue just helps the bolus of food enter the esophagus. Teeth are really important for chomping big pieces down into smaller pieces. What's another name for pharynx? If you have a pharyngitis, you have a sore throat, right? Okay. So I see pharynx right over here. Small intestine. All right, good. I talked about all of those things. But you know what I forgot to talk about in the respiratory chapter? You just told me something really nice. When you have an inflammation of the pharynx, we call that a sore throat, and that just hurts. Okay? But you can get an inflammation in that general area of another structure, and you lose your voice. That is called laryngitis. That's not a pharyngitis, that's laryngitis, and you lose your voice because where are your vocal cords? In your larynx, right? So laryngitis, can't talk. Pharyngitis, it just hurts to swallow, hurts to eat something. Okay, so that's a pretty good introduction to the digestive system. And like a lot of things, we want to know a lot about layers. What happened to my layers of the digestive tract? And that is even important in lab, right? We have a model of these different layers. And layers are so important because we have to know layers because that's how people come up with a diagnosis of what kind of pathology is happening when these layers get disturbed, right? If more layers are involved, then it's a more serious progression of the disease. And why do you need a good diagnosis of something that's going bad inside your body? Because without a diagnosis, you don't know how to treat it, right? So we need to know a lot about these layers. Okay, there's not too many layers. Let's start with the most superficial, the one on the outside of this tube. That's a connective tissue sheath that we call the serosa. I think you had to know that for the quiz on the stomach today in lab, right? So here is the serosa, and it's an epithelium and some connective tissue, so sometimes we can consider that a membrane. A membrane is epithelium with some connective tissue. And it's a pretty strong membrane, so that means it has collagen fibers in it. Okay, so that's the first layer. The next deepest layer I see right here looks red. How'd I do? Does it look red to you? Good. Okay, this is smooth muscle. And the smooth muscle, I see that there are two layers, right? So the next layer can be broken down into two. And the most superficial layer, we say, has longitudinal muscle because the fibers are aligned along the axis of the tube. So these fibers, when they contract, they'll make the tube shorter. That's their job, right? It will pull the ends of the tube closer together. And then underneath, there's another orientation of muscle fibers, right? So if we look at, instead of a longitudinal section, a cross section, now the muscle fibers in that deeper layer look long. When these contract, it doesn't make the tube shorter, it just closes down the tube. It constricts the tube. So this is what we call a circular, right? So longitudinal, make the tube shorter. The circular here, constrict the tube, and that can have a couple of different purposes. These two layers make up the muscularis externa. Muscularis externa. Then that takes us to the third layer. It's called the submucosa. And the submucosa has a lot of blood vessels in it, and it has glands for secreting into the small intestine. It also has that lymphatic tissue that we call MALT. Mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue, which helps fight infection so that if there are bacteria in your alimentary canal, they just can't get into your body very easily. Right, so there's glands and lymphatic tissue and blood vessels in the submucosa. And then the deepest layer is what we call the mucosa. Right, the lining of the tube. What kind of tissue lines a cavity or lines a tube or covers a surface? Yeah, we learned about this way back. Seems like months ago. It was months ago. It's an epithelium. Yeah, there's an epithelium. Okay, so I see the epithelium right here, and the epithelium changes a little bit depending on what part of the digestive system it's in. Like in your mouth, right, we want to consider your mouth part of your alimentary canal. What is that epithelium in your mouth? We looked at it. We made a slide of those cells. Okay, like those buccal cells, cheek cells. It's a stratified squamous epithelium. So with a toothpick, we could just scrape a couple cells off, look at them underneath the microscope, and that's no big deal because what was underneath those cells that we scraped off? More cells, right? We replaced the ones that we scraped off, so that's not such a big deal. And other parts of the digestive system, it might be cuboidal. And in other parts, it might be columnar. All depends on what the job of that particular segment of the intestine is. All right, so that's the epithelium. And then there's some connective tissue. Sometimes we call this lamina propria. And again, there's more glands and there's malt, right? Glands for secreting compounds into the digestive tract. And then malt is to part of your immune response to fight infection. Okay, so there's a lot of lymphatic tissue everywhere around here. So again, because all of your intestines have a lot of lymphatic tissue, you can afford to lose some immune system structures like tonsils and appendix, and you'll still be fine after that because you have these immune system cells all over your body. All right, so those are the layers. The four major layers are serosa, muscularis externa, submucosa, and then the mucosa. Submucosa just means what? Underneath the mucosa. Ah, but you know what? As I was looking through here, I missed one layer. It is part of the mucosa. I mentioned lamina propria, but I see some more red things right here. What do these red things represent? Yeah, just like the muscularis externa, there is muscle. There's another thin layer of muscle, and that's called the muscularis mucosa. Where is that? Right here. Muscularis mucosa, so it's in the mucosa layer. And again, what are all these smooth muscles for? They're for motility, right? Motility. They can move things around, like digesting material. Oh, good. Look, here I mentioned malt. Here it is. Mucosa-associated lymphoid tissue. It's even on this diagram. Nice. Here's a duct of a gland. Okay. I'm glad I didn't make anything up. All right, the last thing that's pretty interesting, all of these looks like yellow to me. You see all this network of yellow fibers running around everywhere? These are nerve fibers, and it's part of the myenteric nerve plexus. Myenteric kind of refers to digestive system, and there are more nerves in your digestive tract than there are in your spinal cord. So I found that really kind of surprising. And there's so many nerves that anatomists way back when, hundreds of years ago, when they saw all these nerves in the digestive tract, actually thought your digestive system was your brain that controlled everything in your body because it had so many nerves. But you know what? You don't really think very much with your digestive tract. All these nerves are there just to control the process of digestion and moving food through the digestive tract or through the alimentary canal. It just takes a lot of reflexes and a lot of nerves to do that, and even some hormones to do that. All right, so now I think I covered everything. All right, so more nerve fibers in your digestive tract than even your spinal cord. Yeah, question. Okay. I say it just a little bit louder. I didn't quite hear. Ah, mesentery. Okay, mesentery is going to be superficial to the serosa, right? So I see mesentery. Did you see it labeled on this slide? This is mesentery. Ah, mesentery right here. Yeah, mesentery is part of, let's see if you can remember this. The mesentery is part of the peritoneal membrane, right? And the peritoneal membrane could either be in the abdominal cavity, right, or the pelvic cavity, and it's a serous membrane, and this part of the mesentery that touches these visceral organs, this is the visceral division of the peritoneum or peritoneal cavity or peritoneal membrane, peritoneum. Right? And since this part is suspending all of these tubes, like the small intestine, and this connective tissue is loaded with blood vessels, arteries, veins, nerves, even lymphatic vessels move through here. All right, we give this little suspending connective tissue the name mesentery. Mesentery surrounds the stomach, but it's really obvious around the small intestine. And you'll see that in lab. That's really easy to see in lab, mesentery. All right, so that's just connective tissue. Okay, any other questions regarding layers? All right, let's see what we got next. Ah, a lot of muscles in the alimentary canal. These are important for motility. And there are two kinds of motility in the alimentary canal. Okay, and one is called peristalsis, and the other is called segmentation. And both are on this slide right here. Peristalsis is contraction of muscles so that digesting food moves from your mouth toward your anus, right, in just that direction. Doesn't ever go backwards. It's just one direction. It just moves food in one direction. So you can see some circular smooth muscles contract. And then what happens? So right here, the smooth muscle is contracting. And then what happens to move this bolus of food along? Smooth muscles contract down over here, right? And then down over here, and then down over here. And we can see that process where contraction of these circular smooth muscles actually moves this bolus of food through the alimentary canal. So peristalsis is moving in an antegrade fashion. Segmentation, on the other hand, is what's used for mixing components, mixing food that we've eaten with digestive enzymes, okay, or other things, like things that can adjust the pH inside the alimentary canal. So segmentation works, right, by the following method. So here we have three columns, right? In the first column, we have some food in this segment that is a really light color. Go ahead, tell me what color. I have no idea what color this is. Pink? Beige. Okay, beige. All right, beige. Let's say pink. Okay, and then there's another little compartment that's separated from the top one because of contraction of smooth muscle, circular smooth muscle, and this one down here is dark red. Yeah, good. Okay, and then we have another compartment that's cordoned off from these other ones by some contraction of smooth muscle, and it's pink again, right? All right, so what happens then for mixing is that this contraction moves halfway across this chamber and contracts again, right? So this contraction moves down to here, this one moves down to here, and it cuts these compartments in half. So now what do we have? A compartment that's half pink and half dark red, right, or beige and red. So these two compartments have been partially mixed together as a result of this process that we call segmentation. And this process repeats itself and repeats itself and repeats itself until, what, you have just a nice homogeneous mixture of material in the alimentary canal. And this material hasn't moved any closer, right, to the mouth or toward the anus. It has just been mixed. Right, if it moved along the digestive tract, what kind of motility would we call that? That's what we would call peristalsis, right? Peristalsis. Okay, segmentation is just mixing. All right. Well, I want to take a little account of some things that get secreted into your alimentary canal. All right, so as soon as you start to eat something or even think about eating something, your salivary glands go to work. And during a day, they secrete about 1.5 liters of saliva into your mouth. I don't have a bottle. What's 1.5 liters? Does that strike you? That's pretty much, right? A liter is a lot. That's 1 liter, right? Hold it up really high. Here's 1 liter. So 1.5 of these things. So if you went around all day long and spit into that bottle, you would need more than one, right? You'd need two of them, and the second one you'd fill up halfway. All right, so that's a lot of fluid. All right, so why are we interested in that? Is fluid important to maintain inside your body? Yeah, otherwise you become dehydrated. Or salt concentrations change, right? And that changes the electrical properties of everything, like your heart, right? So maintaining proper fluid balance is important, but here your body has lost 1.5 liters. Okay, I'm going to jot that down in my mind. All right, then after that, food moves into the stomach, and let me get a picture of a stomach. Stomach is kind of interesting. Usually we think of the digestive system as being really important for digestion. That's how it got its name. And where the heck is the stomach at? Ah, here's a good stomach. I didn't scroll far enough. All right, so here is the esophagus. Here is the stomach. And the stomach kind of looks like just a really big sack. And that kind of tells you what the function is. It stores all the food that we eat that comes down the esophagus, and it holds it there until the small intestine, starting with the duodenum, is ready to process the food. Right? So the stomach is like a holding area, and it can stretch out. And it can stretch out because it's loaded with these folds that we call rugae. Right? And you can eat and eat and eat, and it stretches the stomach out, and the stomach just holds that food. And it can mix that food with acid that's secreted by the mucosa, and that acid will help digest material. It will also activate some other enzymes. But there's very little digestion that takes place, only some initial digestion of proteins, but no digestion of lipids or sugars anymore. All right, so digestion is a really minor function of the stomach. Another thing that the stomach secretes into the lumen, right here, it's just the internal chamber, is something called intrinsic factor. Intrinsic factor is a compound that's necessary for you to absorb vitamin B12. And B12 is important for mitosis. Without vitamin B12, mitosis is really hampered. And mitosis is good to what? To replace and repair damaged tissues. One tissue that replaces itself very frequently are red blood cells. Right? And so without vitamin B12, you can't replace red blood cells. What's that condition called? Anemia. Yeah, anemia, when you can't make enough red blood cells, when you lose more red blood cells than you can make. Right? So vitamin B12 is very important because it supports mitosis all over your body. You can't absorb it unless you have a stomach secreting intrinsic factor. All right, well, some people, to help manage their weight, right, elect to have their stomach stapled or somehow reduced so that it isn't so big, so they can't quite eat as much as what they're used to, and then they lose weight. I've never heard of a stomach being completely removed, but, oh, you know, if there's cancer in the stomach, it might be completely removed. Right, and so now this person in their body isn't secreting any intrinsic factor. Right, what do they need then? Intrinsic factor helps you absorb vitamin B12. What do they need then? They need a shot of vitamin B12 every once in a while, right, in order to maintain all that mitosis that's taking place in their body. So there's some side effects to all of these different kinds of surgeries. Okay, and that mixture, right, of acid and intrinsic factor is what we call gastric juice. And that's what the stomach secretes into the lumen. If we mix food with gastric juice, right, then we get something called chyme. Chyme is digesting material that's in the stomach that gets passed into the small intestine. All right, so you see some of the anatomy of the stomach right here, right? The muscularis externa has 3 layers instead of 2 because the important job of the stomach is segmentation, is mixing. So it's got to be a powerful muscle for mixing. So we see an additional layer. And the stomach is curved, right? This more lateral curvature is very large and long. We call that the greater curvature, right? But the more medial curvature is kind of short. We call that the lesser curvature of the stomach. And then the stomach, besides rugae, right, has got some areas. The area that's very close to the esophagus is called the cardiac region or cardia. Cardiac region. The region that is above the cardia, and it's formed by this dome, this is what we call the fundus or fundic region. And students mix these two areas up frequently, right? So make sure you know where the cardiac region is and where the fundic region is. What's a good landmark to know if you're in the cardiac region? The esophagus, right? That's right. So if you're up over here where there's no esophagus, that can't be the cardiac region. This has got to be the fundus, right? Or the fundic region, this dome shape. Okay, I know on a lot of tests, students will label this area cardiac region, but don't, right? Because it's not. What region is this? This is the fundic region, yeah. Okay, and then down below the fundic region is the body. There's the body of the stomach. And then after that, we have the pyloric antrum. And it's going to get very, so this is an area of the stomach that is really close to the pyloric sphincter. All right, so this is the entrance into this pyloric region. This is a circular smooth muscle, and it can contract and can completely constrict the opening between the stomach and the small intestine. So nothing can move out of the stomach. So this pyloric sphincter is really strong, and it's really big. It's easy to palpate. You can do this in lab with your fingertips. You can feel this smooth muscle right here. So here's the pyloric sphincter. This area that's funneling material into this region right here is called the pyloric canal, and then even a little bit proximal to that is the pyloric antrum. Okay, so the job of the stomach is just to hold food that we eat and then mix some contents with that, mix that gastric juice that it's secreting with that food to produce chyme. But not so much digestion, not so much absorption. As a matter of fact, I could probably say almost no absorption takes place in the stomach. All right, so we said that it secretes stuff into, it secretes gastric juice. And how much gastric juice, how much saliva was secreted so far into the alimentary canal? 1.5 liters. How much gastric juice? All right, again, about 1.5 liters gets secreted into the alimentary canal. So now we're up to 3 liters of fluid or 3 liters of water that your body has lost. Okay. All right, so then food, digesting food, moves into the small intestine, and the small intestine can make digestive enzymes, but it also gets digestive enzymes from the pancreas. And so this is where most of the digestion of food that we eat takes place. That is in the small intestine, because this is where most of the digestive enzymes end up. And food gets broken down into smaller components, like proteins get broken down into, can anybody tell me what's a building block of a protein? Amino acids, that's right. Amino acids can be absorbed in your body. So proteins are broken down into amino acids. And triglycerides, which is a fat, a triglyceride is broken down into fatty acids. And what else should you know about that? Complex sugars like starch, okay, can be broken down into simple sugars, monosaccharides, and probably a really good example of that would be glucose. It's just a nice simple sugar. Okay, so all of these compounds do have building blocks that can be broken down, and that's what happens in the small intestine. And once these things are broken down, proteins into amino acids, then amino acids can be absorbed. And once complex sugars are broken down, then glucose can be absorbed into your body. And then your body might elect to put them back together, but in a different way, because you don't have the same kind of proteins that some other animal does, right? Okay. But the same building blocks. All right, so what do you need for absorption in your body? I see something right there. What do you need? What is that right there? You need a... Can I do this for you in class? What is this right here? This is a doorway. Did we measure this doorway? I think we did. Didn't we measure that? Yeah. You need a doorway. And doorway is another way of thinking of surface area, right, for exchange. All right. So remember, the doorway in your lungs, the surface area of your lungs for exchange is, what, half of a tennis court, 80 square meters. That's pretty big. All right. So what's the surface area for absorption in your small intestine? Let's see if we can understand some of the basis of that, some of the principles involved in that. So let's go to this picture right here. Here's a pretty nice cross-section of a small intestine, and you see some of the common areas or common layers that you're familiar with, like the serosa, right? And then the longitudinal circular muscles of the muscularis externa, and then you see some submucosa, and you can even see some of the mucosa itself. Now, when you look at this tube, it looks smooth and flat on the outside, but if you look on the inside, is it smooth and flat? No, it's all wrinkled up. Okay? These are what we call folds. A better way of saying it, these are circular folds because they go a circle, right? They go around in a circle. So this is one way that the surface area of the small intestine increases, because if you flattened out all of these circular folds, what would happen to the length of the small intestine? It would get longer, right? So all these folds are there so that you don't have this super long tube. It's long enough already. It can fit into a smaller space inside your body, but you still have what? You still have a larger doorway for exchange, right? Because the surface area is big. So that's the first thing. Circular folds sometimes are called plicae circularis, which means circular folds. Pleats are fold in something. Okay, so folding is the first thing that increases the surface area. Okay, and so I see some of these big folds, and what else do you see? I see like these little finger-like projections sticking up. These are almost microscopic. You can almost see them with your naked eye. You can tell that the inside lining of the small intestine is not flat and smooth, but it kind of looks velvety because of all these finger-like projections sticking up. These are what we call villi. And if we really wanted to measure the surface area of the small intestine, we would have to pull it enough to flatten out all of the plicae circularis, but what else would we have to do? Pull it enough to flatten out all of these villi so that they don't poke up anywhere, so they're flat. So what would happen to the length of the small intestine if we were to flatten out all of these folds, the circular folds, and all of the villi? It would even get longer, which means what? Increase surface area, the doorway gets bigger. But that's really fortunate because now this big, huge, long tube can fit inside our body. All right, so that's two things. The circular folds and the villi. And the villi are lined with an epithelium. Let's see if I can find an epithelium. Oh, yeah. All right, so let's zoom in. I don't see a zoom-in box, but let's zoom in maybe to this region right here where I'm circling the cursor. Let's just look at a couple villi. We see that on the next slide. All right, so here is a villus. Now it's really enlarged so that we can see what's going on. Now we can see the epithelium. It's got some, and it looks like, what, nice columnar cells. It also looks like there's some goblet cells right there. The stomach has a lot of goblet cells because these goblet cells secrete mucus onto the surface of the stomach and the small intestine. And mucus is a really tough compound. It's hard to digest. So that mucus acts as what? A really nice barrier between all that digestive bacteria that's happening in the lumen and the wall of the intestine that helps protect the intestine. Okay, so I see some nice goblet cells right there. Now, let's zoom in to some of these cells, and they could be cuboidal cells or columnar cells, and I see it right here. There's a special border, right, on the apical surface. Remember, the apical surface is the surface that's pointing into the lumen of the digestive tract. And what do you see on the apical surface of this cell? Okay, I saw circular folds, I saw villi, which is another fold, and what are these? Even a third kind of folding pattern. These are what we call microvilli. So if we really wanted to measure the effective length of this small intestine, we'd have to straighten out the circular folds, flatten out all of these villi, but even at the cellular level, we'd have to stretch that cell out, each of those cells, to flatten out all of these microvilli. So now you have a tremendously long tube that fits into a nice, really small space. These things are what we call microvilli. We kind of mentioned them the first week of class, but didn't really see where they were. They're inside the digestive tract. They increase the doorway for absorption of nutrients. Okay, when we come back, right, I'll tell you what the surface area of the small intestine is. Okay, and hopefully I can tell you what it is without all these folds and what it is with these folds. Do you think it's like the size of half of a tennis court? Oh. It's even bigger. Okay, here's your sign-in sheet. Too bad I didn't pass it around. Okay, so everybody's absent today. Uh-oh.